It's 8:06. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, Democrat Jackie Cilley, says her campaign for New Hampshire governor is about critical issues facing our state: public education, the university system, infrastructure, and especially jobs. But Cilley, a former state lawmaker, is perhaps best known in this gubernatorial race as the one major candidate who has not taken New Hampshire's longtime pledge against broad-based income or sales taxes. In fact, in a recent TV ad, Cilley has a little fun with those who do follow that tradition, likening them to the undead.
This no tax pledge is turning our politicians into pledge zombies, all doing the same thing, not listening to anyone. Don't even try having a conversation with them. I'm Jackie Cilley, and let's get serious about what's at stake.
But the political graveyard has often been the fate for candidates like Cilley who've rejected the pledge. That's why the outcome of this Democratic primary between Cilley and her main rival, former Senator Maggie Hassan, will be seen as a Democratic referendum on New Hampshire's unique tax structure. Today in The Exchange, Jackie Cilley is here. And let's get your comments and questions in too. Democrats, this is your primary, so we want to hear from you today. What do you want to know about where Jackie Cilley stands on the issues? In what direction do you want the next governor to take our state? And if you're an undecided Democrat in this primary, what information might help you make your choice? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Senator Cilley, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's jump right in on that pledge issue. You have not shied away from this at all, but zombies? Really?
we took a rather fun and humorous approach to a topic that is very serious. It's first of all, you have to understand there are about 73 pledges out there. I don't take any of them, and it's time. And I think we've heard it on both sides of the aisle to get serious about what the challenges are ahead and to face them head on, realistically, without pandering and without taking pledges. I'm proud to say that Judd Gregg, a couple of days ago, said that anybody who's not talking about both sides of the ledger, not talking about revenues, is being irresponsible in this election.
Was he talking about that vis-a-vis
he was
the congressional
talking about the
elections?
State? No, 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 no. He was talking about New Hampshire, and he was talking also about the federal level. He's teamed up with Democrats to take that show on the road to educate people as to what's at stake. The other night, we had one candidate for the House that had a bonfire party and burned 19 pledges. We're hearing from across the state that people have decided to take it on. And it's time. We're on the right side of the issue. We're on the right side of history. And I also would like to separate out the whole issue of taking pledges from any discussion of revenue. The only thing pledges do is to shut down conversations. It says to a legislature, 424 people, if you come up with a plan that's a better plan than anything we have today, I'm not listening. I'm not listening because I've taken a pledge. And that's not a way to govern. It's not independence. And we've heard that now from across the country and across the state.
Let me ask you about that, what you just said. You're not saying, if elected, I promise to impose an income or sales tax. You're saying, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about it.
Thank you for making that distinction. I've said we'll take no pledges. And as I said, that's a separate conversation from how do we resource government to meet our priorities, to provide the services that not only our citizens need, but our businesses need. Sometimes folks forget that businesses rely on the services that government provides just as much as the citizens do. There are services that help us to grow our economy. We need investments in our schools, in our bridges, in our roads, in communication infrastructure, and making sure we have safe, healthy communities. Those investments have to be reviewed first. And you know that my background's business. So any good business leader looks at both sides of the ledger. What are you trying to provide? How do you do it in the most cost-efficient, effective manner? And then what are the revenues needed to make sure that you're providing them?
How do you respond, Senator Cilley, to the suspicion, though, that talking about income and sales taxes leads to doing it. And let me just add on, you said in a forum earlier this year, we don't ride horse and buggies anymore. We need to get rid of our outdated tax policy. It's killing us. So that does sound like, if elected, you would come up with a plan to change our tax structure.
I would love to find a way to reform our tax structure. And we are bringing great minds to the table. And what I remind people everywhere I go is that in the days before pledge politics, when our elected officials could say everything's on the table, a very well-respected Republican governor, Walter Peterson, said the same thing. And he looked at the business environment in New Hampshire, and he said, it's not working. It's not working any more than what we've got today is working. So he brought people to the table. They sat down and actually went over every single tool available. They came up with a business profits tax. Business profits tax today is too high because we rely way too heavily on it. But what that did at that time in the 1970s was eliminate 18 separate property-related business taxes. 18.
So it was a big improvement. If we could do
that today and ensure that that would be the case— You betcha I'm going to be looking at it.
Well, let's get to what you said then. It's not working. As you well know, Senator Silly, a lot of people say, yes, it is working. They look at other states. They say New Hampshire didn't fare as poorly in the recent downturn. We're doing relatively better than other states in this sluggish recovery. How do you respond to that? New Hampshire's doing better, and many people feel it is because of our unique low tax structure.
I'm a New Hampshire born and bred native. I have no interest in turning this state into a huge government state, into one that, I mean, we have family here. Four of our five children live in this state. Eight of our grandchildren live here. I don't want to see them burdened. They are barely, middle class at this point. So what I'm looking for is a way to make sure that our tax structure is fair. It allows us to move forward. It funds our priorities, allows us to position this state to meet the challenges of the 21st century. And for those who say we're doing a great job, I have news for them. There are some very, very troubling signs. I mean, and again, I'll go back to my business background and, what I know about economics. If you look at the underpinnings, there are often ways that you can predict what the future holds. So we're looking now at the numbers. The CNBC report recently dropped our economic ranking from 10th to 34th. CNBC ranks states on their economic strength. They dropped us from 10th to 34th. They dropped our educational rankings, our infrastructure rankings, and our workforce development rankings. Forbes, a few months ago, dropped us from number 19 as one of the best states to start or relocate a business to number 28 behind the most taxed state in the country, New York, which is creating jobs faster than we are. Massachusetts, number 19, which is creating number 18, which is creating jobs faster than we are. We lost 3,800 jobs in the state last year. Our in-migration patterns, those people who come here, are down to 1950s levels. If you ask any economist in this state, they will tell you that our workforce has grown and has accrued the diversity that it has because we bring people here. We're down to 1950s levels. We're one of the fastest aging states in the country. If we continue down this path, we're going to be seniors taking care of seniors. That's an untenable place to be.
It'd be hard to convince voters, though, that an income tax is going to solve those problems.
I'm not stumping for an income tax. I am not stumping for an income tax, nor a sales tax, nor any other type of a tax. I've said rational minds that don't wed themselves to antiquated pledges. And remember, as I said, there are 73 pledges. One of them says we're going to cut taxes, cut government, cut spending, and, oh, by the way, turn us into a right-to-work-for-less state. So, there are all of these anti-tax pledges out there. Grover Norquist has his. And many of our legislators today have taken them. They shackle themselves to special interests and to out-of-state interest. That's not a way to govern. And we're hearing that. As I said, Judd Gregg, Kelly Ayotte, has said, no more pledges. She takes a pledge to the Constitution, to uphold the Constitution. That's it. We're seeing brave souls step forward and say enough.
Two more questions on this, and then I do want to get to some of the other issues, because I know you've talked so much about infrastructure and public education, mm-hmm. So we'll get to that. Governor Lynch, a Democrat, has always supported the pledge. Your main Democratic rival, Maggie Hassan, told us a couple weeks ago she just doesn't feel like this is the right time to raise taxes on anyone. Let's not talk about taxes right now. Things are tough, and let's keep things the way they are for folks, at least in terms of their tax bills.
I'm not suggesting that we raise taxes on anyone. As I said, we've got four of our five children live in the state. They pay property taxes. They know what the burden of those property taxes are, and all of your listeners do as well. As we've crisscrossed the state and gone from North Stuartstown to the border in Salem and from Keene to Portsmouth, we've heard of families losing their homes. We've heard of seniors being foreclosed on that have their mortgages are paid. They're losing their homes. And it is at a faster rate than other states. So we've got a problem here and that needs to be faced head on realistically with realistic solutions. So the last thing I want to do is raise the tax burden on anybody. But there, as I said, just as with Governor Peterson's plan to eliminate 18 separate property-related business taxes, we can find solutions if we're willing to come to the table with an open mind and say it's all there. And that's and I will say that I think Judd Gregg stole my line, because in his article in the Union Leader 2 days ago, that's exactly what he said. Everything has to be on the table. Everything.
Last question on this, Senator Silly, and it's a political question. How do you respond to those Democrats who, you know, like what you're saying, but who fear that if you're the nominee, the Republicans will for sure win the corner office?
That's not true, because we're hearing from independents and Republicans. I have a great deal of support straight across the aisle. You know, I went to a Rotary meeting recently. I had at least six people come up and say to me, just on the basis of the pledge alone, my refusal to accept any pledges, thank me for that stance and ask for signs, bumper stickers, pins.
But Mark Fernald got nailed on this a bunch of years back when he ran.
Again. Mark was talking about an income tax. I am not talking about an income tax. There are two issues. One is, do you take pledges to outside special interest to say, I don't have to think about this, I don't have to listen to you, I've signed a pledge, I'm going to veto anything? And remember, we have 424 legislators. When you take a pledge to veto something, and first of all, it's a very negative way to govern. When you take a pledge to veto, you have just told 424 legislators, no matter how brilliant the plan is, you're not going to listen to them.
We'll start taking your calls after a short break and talk about a lot more issues in this gubernatorial primary with Jackie Silly. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
It's The Exchange on NHPR. Good morning. I'm Mike Danielli. Join NHPR as we help celebrate the 21st annual North Country Moose Festival. We'll be in Colebrook Friday to help kick off the celebrations. Stop by our booth and say hello. More information on the Moose Festival at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Golf Wilson, a global immigration law firm helping businesses and individuals achieve successful immigration solutions. Online at golfwilson.com. And from Antioch University, New England, educating practitioner scholars with their doctoral program in clinical psychology. AntiochNE.edu. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we continue our coverage of New Hampshire's gubernatorial primary with Democratic candidate Jackie Silly. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Senator Silly, before we dive into some of the other issues, we talked earlier about the income and sales tax pledge, and there's a lot of other issues in this race. I do want to get a little biography of you, though, because you've talked a lot about it in this campaign. Talking about your tough beginnings as the daughter of a mill worker in Berlin, how tough was it?
It was very tough. When your father's a logger and he's out of work half of the year, there were lean times. But it's interesting to think. I mean, remember, Berlin is a mill community. Many families were affected the same way. So we were in it together. I think there was a sense of community that I worry isn't as prevalent today. So there wasn't that comparison of what do you have? What do I have? You know, is there enough to get by? I mean, we were in it together. And neighbors helped neighbors. So it was a wonderful community to be brought up into. As you know, my tradition is I'm a factory girl at heart. That's really where my beginnings were. My grandfather, I've talked about my grandfather Elwood many times on the stump, and he worked at the Brown Paper Mill Company. My father drove a logging truck for them. My mother and grandmother worked in the Wear Knitters T-shirt factory, and I actually started working for the Converse Rubber Company, which made sneakers.
How many kids in the family?
There were five of us.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, and it was, as I said, Berlin was a thriving community at that time, by the way. It was about 16,000-17,000. We had a couple of movie theaters. We had a great community center where a lot of us, you know, hung out, played pool, swam, and so on. They're under 9,000 today.
Yeah.
If you look at the history of Berlin, 22,000 to 23,000 at one time, the fourth largest city in the state, and 8 trains a day coming in and out with passengers and cargo.
How did you end up being the only person in your family to go to college?
I actually think the beginnings of that were with a Latin teacher that I had in my junior year who looked, Mrs. Mary Finnegan. She looked at me and said, "So where are you going to college?" And I said, "Mrs. Finnegan, don't you understand who I am?" I said, "Nobody in my family has gone to college. In fact, about half of them had not had the opportunity to finish high school." And she said, "Well, who are you?" I said, "I'm from a third floor walk-up tenement. Nobody's ever gone." She said, "We don't let a little thing like that stop us." And she went on at the age of 88. She went on and finished her PhD at Plymouth. So she was a great inspiration. And, you know, and coming up in a mill family, they certainly taught me the work ethic and the go-to spirit that, you know, that you can accomplish what you wanted to accomplish. So I was about 29 when I went to the university, and it was a proud moment to be accepted. I, at that point, had one child in tow and my oldest son.
Definitely a non-traditional student,
student, and made my way by typing an awful lot of other students' papers. Those were in the days of selective typewriters and so on. But cobbled together a living for us. I worked for a mental health center in Dover and did a lot of typing in the middle of the night. Fortunately, I don't need much sleep. And got through, and by then, before I finished, I had met my husband, and we got married. Finished my undergraduate degree in psychology. I love saying I took it home, tried practicing on the family, was not very good at domestic harmony. Went on and got my master's degree in business, and that has served me particularly well.
Well, how do you think this upbringing shapes your political views, Senator Cilley? And if you could, in that answer, how do you think it makes your political views different from your main Democratic rival, Maggie Hassan?
I think one of the things about that upbringing is that when you go through your life where nothing is given to you. You have to work for everything. You become very realistic in the way you work for it. It's not pie in the sky. It's not wishful thinking. The only way you move on is by looking at your challenges face on and finding realistic solutions for them. So that's part of it. And also, the other thing is that I think people have noticed as I've gone from place to place in New Hampshire is they understand I've walked in the shoes of virtually every citizen in our state. I mean, remember, I worked on a factory floor. I've worked in an office. I've worked in an academic setting. I'm a mom. I'm a grandmother. I'm a property taxpayer. My kids pay property taxes. The experience, you know, I was saying the other night at an event, I don't know when property taxes come for an awful lot of folks in the state of New Hampshire, but I do know when they come in Barrington. And we get them just before Christmas. Just before Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Right. And so, you know, through the years, it's, you know, you look at that and you say, you know, what does that mean for the kids, for the grandkids, for Christmas?
Let's go to our listeners, and then we'll talk some more. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And Matthew is up first, calling in from Milford. Hi, Matthew. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to commend the senator, first of all, on her stance on taking pledges. I think that's great. We have much hardline approaches to compromise and politics in this country. But on the subject of revenue building, I was wondering where the senator stands on the subject of expanded gambling.
Big issue in this race. Thank you very much for the call, Matthew. Go ahead, Senator Cilley.
And thank you, because it has been a question everywhere we've gone. What I have said is that it's very clear to me in talking with folks around the state that there are many places that do not want expanded gaming. You should know that the benefits of gaming go to the state. any issues related to it are felt at the local level. So where they don't want it, they shouldn't have it. I wouldn't support it. On the other hand, it's I don't think the Seacoast should speak for Salem. Salem wants it, Pelham Hudson. So what I have said is that I would listen, as I would to anything, and that within that, it would have to there would have to be very, very good oversight, and there would have to be a wall between that industry and its ability to buy legislative influence.
How do you do that, though?
We're looking
easier
at
said
that.
Than done.
It is much easier said than done, and it's and I frankly find it very disturbing that there are candidates, you know, in the gubernatorial race that are shopping plans that I have seen. You know, Millennium Gaming's plan has been presented, and those are the things that, you know, that are being put on the table right now, where one has a client and the other has a lobbyist.
Who are you talking about there?
It's the subject of gambling should be looked at very, very carefully. As you know, Governor Lynch has looked at it very carefully. I also think that we need to look at 43 states that have expanded gaming, what their experience is, and we should learn from that. I mean, I know that Foxwoods, for example, is $2 billion in the hole. Mohegan Sun has had to restructure. So we would look at it. We'd listen to the communities. What I will say is that it is not the answer to our, you know, fiscal challenges. The New Hampshire Public Policy has put out a paper saying that I think the last time that I looked at it, it was around $45 to $100 million. But that was before the casino was being built 10 miles over the border from Salem.
Right. No, let me ask you a couple questions. And you talked about other candidates, and it's important to know who you're talking about here because this is a primary race. So I know that Over the Montagne, who we spoke to last week, has said he supports one casino at Rockingham. Kevin Smith, we talked to yesterday.
I believe his firm represents Rockingham Park.
Right. And he says, look, if I'm governor, obviously I'm not going to work for the firm anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin Smith said he supports two licenses, but decided at the state level. He doesn't say, let's pick winners and losers here. Are you saying that's also not the way to go? Or what are you saying there? I'm not really clear on where you stand on this issue.
I'm not sure, you know, why Kevin has changed a bit of his thinking on this. But that is, you know, that's another plan that's out there.
So how do you feel about it? I'm not getting a clear sense of how you feel about gambling. Should we or shouldn't we expand it? You're saying, not sure yet. I'm just trying to get a sense of
where you stand. No, I'm saying that in those communities that have asked for it, remember, Salem has sent their select board to testify for it. They've sent their executive director of their Chamber of Commerce, I think their police chief. I almost think that I heard that their Lutheran minister came up and testified for it. So I think we should listen very, very carefully. But however, I also believe that we need to have very clear oversight. It took Massachusetts well over a year to you know, to get the kind of oversight in place that they needed, and it also there's also the challenge of making sure that that is not you know, that they can't influence through financial backing anybody's plan.
I also want to talk to you about another issue that's come up in this race, and that's the Northern Pass, Senator Silly. And we've talked to all the candidates about this. Just real generally first, how do you feel about this Northern Pass proposal to bring hydropower down from Quebec through northern New Hampshire and onto the New England grid?
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is the question always starts in the wrong place. And unfortunately, in the state of New Hampshire, we have done this far too often. We look at these projects individually as though they stand on their own, out of context with anything else. We need a strategic plan for energy development in the state of New Hampshire. We need to make sure we're putting our people to work. We need to make sure that we support our entrepreneurs and small business people in the generation of power in the state of New Hampshire. That's the first order of business. And then, if we had that plan in place, every one of these projects that come forward, we could look at in the context of something larger, of what we're trying to accomplish and what are the goals for our people, for our state. That said, what I have said in the North Country, and as you know, it is a critical issue for them, is that I don't support the taking of land, whether you're on it for 6 months or six generations. I think that was settled, hopefully, in the legislature this year. I definitely would not support that. I don't support selling our skyscapes to a for-profit company. I sat at John and Cindy Lou Amy's farm up in North Stuartstown. They've been on that farm for generations with some of the most beautiful vistas in our state. They would be looking out over towers, and I can see why they really object to that. So we don't sell our skyscapes, and we don't trade one type of job for another. There are families that have been in the tourism industry for generations, and that is our major industry.
Especially in the North Country
right.
these days.
And then lastly, I've said we're not a conduit from one place to another. That's not what our state should be used for.
So is this a no to Northern Pass? Because it sounds like
no
that.
This is no on all of those things. And what I have said is that Maine, Pennsylvania, and New York have found a way to get to yes. If it is good for our citizens, I would work in that regard. They have found a way to bury it. They have found a way for states to make revenues out of it, and they have found a way to create jobs as that goes along. If we can come to a place where it is the best thing for the citizens of New Hampshire, then that certainly would – I would be taking a look at that. But those things that I outlined – Those things I don't support.
We've talked to project officials many times, and every time we ask about burying the lines, they say, no, it's not economically feasible. And frankly, they say it's also not environmentally feasible because you're doing a lot of digging and disruption there to the forest and so forth. So if they say burying the lines isn't feasible and you say you really need to because there are these other serious impacts, where do you go from there?
They said that in New York. They got to yes in New York.
All right. Let's take some more calls. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And John from Rye is on the air. Thanks for waiting, John. Go ahead. You're on with Jackie Silly.
Sure. Thank you. Like you, Jackie, I grew up in the North Country in 1970. My family of 10, my father being the sole breadwinner as a carpenter, moved to West Milan. And back then, my father could barely, he could just about eke out a living for this large family that we had. And of course, I've grown up in New Hampshire and was educated in the community college system, first as an oil burner technician at the Tech in Manchester. It was a federally funded program, CETA, if anyone remembers that.
John, what's your question for Senator Silly?
Well, my question is, I've become an entrepreneur and have developed many innovative designs of products that are industry standards, but they're all made in China. And I've watched foundries in Franklin and Laconia just fizzle away because we've allowed big companies to try to drive up sales and drive down costs. And the only way you can do that is take away American jobs and ship them to third world countries where they don't play by the same rules that Americans who are looking for that American dream and lifestyle have a different perspective. So we're eroding
away. Outsourcing manufacturing jobs to China. This has definitely been an issue. Thank you so much, John, for raising that point. And this gets to economic development and his very good point.
Well, there are several things. I mean, I've sat on several committees that deal with international trade, the impacts of our trade agreements, for example, while I was in the Senate. Our state does not have to participate. In fact, what's interesting about this is that basically it is the governor's decision, solely the governor's decision, which I find troublesome, to determine whether we're going to participate in some of the international trade pacts. That's something that I would take a very careful look at. I would encourage the legislature to be a part of that process for our own companies. In addition, I think we had a great program for doing exports in the state of New Hampshire. Budget cuts have weakened that program. So we definitely want that where we're creating jobs in New Hampshire and allowing our citizens to export our products. I think we need to reboost that industry because it was being done very, very well under Dawn Wivel when she was heading that up. As I said, I think budget cuts really harmed that program. There is a great deal that goes on at the federal level in this regard, but a state can have its input, and we would expect to be having considerable input on that and attempting in every way to grow jobs right here in New Hampshire. That's critical to us. As I said, we lost 3,800 jobs. We need to be growing jobs here in New Hampshire.
John, thanks for the question. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Give us a call. Jackie Silly is our guest today. She's a Democrat running for governor. Her main rival in this race is former Senator Maggie Hassan. We'd like to hear from you, Democrats, this hour. It's your primary that we're looking at. If you're undecided, what information might help you make up your your mind. What do you want to know about where Jackie Silly stands on the issues? Our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Senator Silly, as I said, this is a Democratic primary, so I'm curious about your differences with Senator Hassan, your political worldview that we've sort of touched on a little bit later, but earlier. But a little bit more on that, please. How do you describe yourself as the better choice over Senator Hassan? This is a choice Democrats have to make at the polls in the fall.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that I'd say. First of all, I'm the only one in this race, right across the spectrum of all of the candidates running, who actually has any real business experience. I've paid business profits tax. I've paid business enterprise tax. My husband owns a business. Two of our children own a business. I have taught over 3,000 business leaders, two of whom, by the way, I ran into over the past week alone, which is kind of nice. I'm the only one in this race that actually understands the underpinnings of an economy and what it takes to jumpstart an economy and where government's role is in that, as well as, you know, as how an economy is harmed and what has happened over the last couple of years. So that's an expertise that I bring with me that nobody else in this race has. Secondly, that background that I've talked about and the life experiences, you bring everything about you to, and that last caller knows it, he was talking about his own upbringing. You bring everything with you that you have learned over a lifetime and the experiences you've had, the challenges you've faced. As I mentioned, you know, we know what it is to struggle with property taxes. We know what it is to try to make a payroll. Those are some of the unique elements that I bring to the table with me into the governor's office. I mean, we both have very similar legislative histories and careers, if you can call it a career for me, because that was never what I intended to be doing. But It is who I am. And it's also, I think, one of the things that differentiates me from all of the other candidates is the fact that I am willing to look a challenge realistically in the eyes and say, here are realistic solutions. You don't do it on wishful thinking. You don't do it on pie in the sky thinking.
Is that what you're suggesting that Senator Hassan
I'm just
is
saying
doing?
What I'm bringing to the table.
There was a couple policy differences, and we're heading into a break, but I want to ask you about one of them real quick. You differed with Senator Hassan and at times with your party in the state Senate against mandatory seatbelt laws and mandatory motorcycle helmet laws. How come?
I did differ at times. I mean, I'm not a party line person. I'm a proud Democrat, but I tend to be very independent. Always have been, and that won't change in the governor's office. And I think it's one of the things, frankly, that a lot of folks really like about me. It's one of the reasons why I'm able to reach across the aisle very, very effectively. Seatbelt bills. We already had one of the highest rates of seatbelt usage in the country. And so we took a look at that and
got to cut you off there. Okay. I will let you finish up after a short break.
Great,
and
thanks.
We'll be right back.
It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Political Library at St. Anselm College, New Hampshire's home for politics. Information at anselm.edu/NHIOP. And from Collins Dentistry for Children, treating the dental needs of infants through teens in southern New Hampshire, with locations in Nashua and Pelham. Details at collinsdentistry.com. This is NHPR.
President Obama opposed the Citizens United decision that created super PACs, but super PACs are where the big money is. The president also has a reputation for not sufficiently stroking major donors. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Mayer about her article on Obama's fundraising problems called Schmooze or Lose. It's published in the current New Yorker. Join us. Fresh Air, today at 3 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jackie Silly is with us talking about the issues in her primary campaign for governor. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Senator Silly, before the break, we were starting to get into a couple issues where you differed with former Senator Hassan, your main rival in this Democratic primary, and your party in general. We were talking about how you voted against mandatory seatbelt laws, mandatory motorcycle helmet laws. I want to let you finish up that point, and then I have another question for you.
Okay, thank you for allowing me to do that, because the biggest issue with the seatbelt bill that was brought is that it was a primary offense bill, which means that you could pull somebody over simply for not having a seatbelt and then move on from there to searching vehicles and so on and so forth. I have great respect for our, you know, police officers. In fact, I enjoy the endorsement of the New England Police Benevolent Association. But I think even they would tell you that it's many of them had trouble with the notion that you could simply be pulled over by not having a seatbelt. That happened to my husband in Maine last week. You know, he's in and out delivering product. He forgot to put a seatbelt on at one point, and he was pulled over just for not having that seatbelt on. So that's a primary offense bill. It's not something that I could support.
There was another issue where you also parted company with your party. Your vote on so-called payday lenders. Democrats, when they were in power, tried to put these companies out of business, saying that they charged exorbitant rates and that low-income people would go in, you know, for that desperately needed money and then be even in worse shape as they'd owe these payday companies tons of money. You voted differently with your party. How come?
I was fighting for a compromise position that kept an option open for folks that had walked in my shoes. And I've told this story over and over again. There was a time in my life where if I blew a tire on a Monday trying to support a child on my own as a single mom, and somebody charged me $20 to be able to pay for that tire because I had nowhere else to turn. Nowhere else to turn. Was that exorbitant? Yes. Losing 4 days' pay was worse. There was a role for, you know, I worked with some of those companies. We were looking for a compromise position where they could survive, but they could all and to eliminate the rollover, which is where they really make their money, because somebody who's in poverty ends up not being able to pay it on Friday, then it gets rolled over, and that's really where they make their money. But the most important thing to me that never happened was that they would partner to provide financial education to citizens who desperately need it. Remember, we still have rent to own, which is four times the amount that it would cost to buy a refrigerator or a stove. We still have plenty of places where folks who don't have good financial education can be taken advantage of. The last thing in the world that I was doing, and Senator Hassan knows this, was protecting companies that preyed on our most vulnerable. I've walked in their shoes. That was the last thing that I was looking for.
Let's take some calls. Our number again, 1-800-892-6477. Joanna's calling in from Sutton. Hi, Joanna, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, Senator Silly, I appreciate you taking a pledge. I think that's great.
Not taking the pledge, Joanna.
Not taking the pledge. Thank you. A little nervous on the radio. Anyway, I'm self-employed and I own a home, and it's a struggle every month trying to pay the mortgage and on top of that property tax. And I really want to hear your stance on how to fund education, but also reduce property tax for people that don't make a lot of money.
So how do you pay for education?
Can I just finish? Like when Clifton Belo was out there, advocating for an income tax, it made a lot of sense to me, and I don't understand why that is completely off the table. So I really want to hear from you, Senator. What is your plan?
Okay, thank you for calling in, Joanna.
Well, first of all, it's not off the table. Nothing is off the table. It's all on the table. And as far as, let me go back to education. I think there were a couple of questions embedded in that one. Education is an absolute top priority for me. It took me out of poverty. It's done so for thousands of our citizens. It's grown the middle class, both here in New Hampshire and across the country. So, and we had, by the way, an objective bipartisan formula that has never been put into place. So
this is funding K-12.
Exactly. And so the first order of business is to go back and revisit that funding formula to determine in the ensuing years what has happened, because it was never fully implemented. We held communities harmless, and then this past legislature didn't implement it either. So we'd start there, and then we would move on from there. But I appreciate her question, because there are also efficiencies, and it's not just in our educational system. There are efficiencies across the board that we still can gain from government. I talked with the superintendent recently, for example. example of three small school districts. He doesn't need a full-time special ed director. He doesn't need a full-time core standards director. He'd like to partner with other communities. I think I would be out there working to have local, because all, as you know, these decisions are made at the local level. So we'd want them to partner and to provide services that are needed at the administrative level in the most cost-effective, efficient manner that they can,
so that
we put more.
Right?
No, there is not
consolidation, sharing of resources.
I think there's more. I think there's more that can be done. He's struggled. This particular superintendent said he struggled to partner with other SAUs, larger SAUs that could share resources. So I think there's more that can be done to make that more efficient, and that so that we're putting the dollars into education directly into the classroom the way we'd want to. And we can do that across government.
This brings up the idea of an education funding amendment. As you know, Governor Lynch this year, along with Senate President Bragdon and House Leader Bill O'Brien, an amazing trifecta of people supporting this education funding amendment, which Lynch said would better help target scarce resources to truly needy school districts like the one you grew up in, Berlin. How would you have voted on this amendment if you had been in the Senate?
I wouldn't. And in fact, I would never vote for it. After watching what's happened in the past 2 years, I wouldn't. My primary opponent, Senator Hassan, has said she would support a targeted amendment. She didn't like the one that was put forward this year. But I have said no targeted amendments. First of all, we don't need them. We can already target resources. What folks don't say is that that has to be targeted after we provide adequate education to every student in the state of New Hampshire. Education should not be an accident of geography, no matter where you live. And so we don't need targeted amendments. What I will say about what happens with an amendment is when you reduce the oversight of the courts and you look at this particular legislature and you look at what went on, it will allow for our educational dollars to be used as a political football. Whoever's in power can decide whether your school gets funded or your school gets funded, whether your school doesn't get funded. It puts it back in the hands of folks that, if they are as extreme as this particular legislature is, can use it as a political football. I think we need the court's oversight.
Don't you think there'd be metrics, though? I mean, you can get extra state aid if you meet these metrics, you know, free and reduced price lunch, English as a second language, families in poverty. I mean, I don't know if the legislature would willy-nilly say, you're my best friend here, you take this money. I mean, you seem to be suggesting that this would be politically decided.
Yes, I think that there is an extreme ideology that, first of all, doesn't even believe in public education. And do I think they'll use it as a political football? Absolutely. There isn't any doubt in my mind. We've seen enough over the last 2 years to question the decision-making of this particular legislature, and we can never guarantee that there won't be another one. So I think that the education of our children is far too precious, far too important. It is the foundation of our economy. It is the foundation of our standard of living moving forward. We do not use that as a political football. And so it's one of the things that, as I said, I just cannot support.
All right. And we could probably go on and on about this.
Oh, we
but
could.
I've got
yes.
A lot more listeners who want to jump in on this conversation, Senator Cilley. So here's an email from Mark who says, I'm a registered independent and mostly vote with Democrats. Here's what Mark says. I'm kind of tired of candidates campaigning on their business backgrounds. Government is not a business. Business and government have different missions. Candidates should be explaining why they would be a good governor versus promoting their business background. I'm not a business owner, and I certainly don't want our state to be run like a business. That's one point Mark makes. Here's his second point, Senator Cilley. I still like the pledge, he says. New Hampshire has a patchwork of taxes. The patchwork structure makes it more flexible than broad-based taxes. I pay very high property taxes. Perhaps it's not the fairest system, but I would prefer high property taxes to a broad-based tax. Mark, thanks for those 2 points. Let's take the second one first, Senator Cilley. I've heard others say this as well. This patchwork of taxes keeps New Hampshire's revenue more stable. It doesn't swing as wildly during recessions. And people like Mark like it that way.
You have to look at who it impacts. I mean, if you look at your lowest two income groups, they're paying anywhere from 9 to 11% of their income in a variety of taxes and fees. Your top income groups pay 1.5% to 2.5%. He's right. It is not a fair system. But what's more troublesome is as your population ages and as the largest single asset that these folks have is their home. We're taxing their home. You know, I met a woman here in Concord at a retail store who told me the story of how she lost her husband 7 years ago. Her mortgage is paid. She's losing her home. A home that they built together, they raised their family in together, she lost him in. What she didn't have to say to me, and by the way, she's paid 10 times in property taxes what they paid for that house. What she didn't have to say to me is once she loses that home, she loses the last physical connection that she has with him. I've heard those stories all over New Hampshire. That's an immoral way to run government. But I want to come back to the point about business and why it's important that somebody who has some business experience go in there. The policies of government, he's quite right. Government is not a business. There are ways that it can be run like a business. We should be looking for performance measurement reviews, which I know sounds like a very businessy term. We should hold people accountable. We should ask them what the goals are for their agency and their department, what they expect to do with our citizens' tax money.
Isn't that happening now? Isn't Governor Lynch
doing
that now?
No, it does not. The legislature does not do enough of this now. We should make sure that we know exactly what is going to be accomplished by the allocations that we make. And then when they come back, we should ask them, what did you accomplish? That's a performance measurement review. How did you do it? Was it done in the most cost-effective manner possible? I should be able to, as governor, I should be able to look at our citizens and say, your tax money is being used as effectively and efficiently as possible. So there are ways that you take business principles into government. The other reason that a business background is critically important is that the policies that are developed within our legislature affect our economy. If you don't understand how it impacts our economy and our ability to stimulate our economy, you've got a problem.
Let's take one more call if we sure. could, Senator Silly. And Mark, thanks a lot for that email. Let's go to George in Meredith. Hi, George. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you so much, Laura. And hi, Candidate Silly. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I can trace myself back to John Miles Locke at Rye Beach in 1650. So I've lived in the state for a long time.
Wow.
Now I have two quick comments and then a question, and I'll try to make it as brief as I can. I've been accused of being, you know, the local limp-wristed liberal and a socialist in disguise for years. But one of the things that my great-great-great-episode-great-grandfather John Locke said, the purpose of government is simply to protect what we have. In other words, protect our property. I think it's very important that we do that. The second comment I have, and I would advise you, candidates, to be very careful when this is going back to the beginning, when you say that pledges are antiquated, because I would remind you that the very last line of the Declaration of Independence of this country says, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And the question I have, to make this long story,
yes, please, George. We're running to the end. I'd love for you to wrap up.
The question I have is: when you put your hand out and become a member of whatever, you know, political thing you're running for, is that not in fact a pledge?
Okay, George. Thanks for the call. Okay.
It is indeed, and it's a very important one, and it is a
when you take the oath of office.
When you take the oath of office, yes. I mean, I pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to our Constitution, and pledge to uphold our Constitution as an oath of office. Those are positive pledges. They are not anti anything. They are to uphold the principles of our state, the principles of our country, and so yes, I think there is a distinction, and I'm sorry that I didn't make it in that case.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for the call, George. And you know, a couple last questions for you, Senator Silly. You and Senator Hassan would both like to replace the Democrat who's held the corner office for some years now, John Lynch. Of course, Democrats, many of them, revere Lynch. They're glad he was there to hold the office mm-hmm. for them over mm-hmm. these many years. But how would you be different? What criticism do you have of the way Governor Lynch has held this office?
You're going to ask me to criticize the most popular governor that New Hampshire's ever had. I won't. I have great admiration for Governor Lynch, and even more that he has held the ship of state steady in the last 2 years. As I've gone around the state, I've asked folks, you know, why do you like him so much? And they say, he shows up, he's there, he's accessible, and they feel that he feels what they're going through.
Some and also so feel that he doesn't stick his neck out on issues that are important to Democrats.
Well, listen, we can all be criticized, right? But I have great admiration for the job he's done. What's the difference? The difference is it's a new day and time. I'm not John Lynch. I don't try to wrap myself in John Lynch. He has served distinguishedly in our state, and I'm thankful that he was there. Today is a different era. We're facing what has happened as a result of this legislature that's going to impact our state is enormous. And so the challenges are different than even what he's faced in the last 8 years. And I'm a different candidate to do that. I will use that platform of government and the skills that I have, the ability to educate, the ability to market the state, all of those things that, getting back to an earlier caller's question about, what does business do? There are business skills that I take with me that will help to tell the story of where New Hampshire stands, where we need to go. We need a governor that has vision right now because we are at a very, very critical crossroads.
I've talked to a couple other gubernatorial candidates, most of whom have said, I would be a more hands-on governor. They've criticized the governor for kind of letting the legislature take the lead and then just saying yes or no.
Governors have different philosophies. I think Governor Lynch is having served with him. I think his philosophy was there are different branches of government for a reason, and that one branch of government does its business, and then when it gets to his where it intersects with his job, then he has a decision to make. I would like to provide a vision in which the legislature can work, which our citizens understand and embrace, and move the state forward to meet the challenges of the 21st century economy.
Well, Senator Cilley, it's been good to talk to you this hour.
It goes too fast, doesn't it?
It does go fast. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
That's Jackie Cilley, again, a former state representative, former state senator, UNH business professor, small business owner, running as a Democrat in the primary for New Hampshire governor. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today is Mike Danielli. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about our program, upcoming shows, and get extra links and material. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.